This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
Frankly, his claims on the economy are laughable. The economy in the UK is the fastest growing in the G7 and is in a significantly better position than it was in 2010. And his claims are completely absurd. But he's using it as an excuse to raise taxes, because his plan has always been to raise taxes. He just didn't have the courage to be honest with the British people about it.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast. In the week, it was revealed Medway Council is chasing £24 million in unpaid council tax, a major crime-fighting initiative has lost its funding, and get ready for tax rises in the October budget. I'm your host, Simon Finlay, local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council, and I'm joined by Robert Boddy, who looks after Medway Council.
Hello.
And by Matt Ramsden, who's going to be looking at the national political picture this week.
Hello.
Regular reporter Dan Isson is taking a well-earned break, but we've got a high-profile guest in the shape of Tom Tugendhat, who is aiming to become the next leader of the Conservative Party. First up, Robert, what's been happening in Medway?
Well, it was reported a couple of weeks ago that nationally the amount of unpaid council tax has reached £6 billion. So I've been looking into what the state of things are in Medway, and I find that over the past 6 years, since the end of the 2018-19 financial year, there is £24 million of unpaid council tax across the towns, and a further nearly £4 million of older council tax than that is still uncollected.
So what's the reason for the council tax going unpaid?
So this has been a rising trend over the years. So in Medway, at the 2018-19 financial year, the amount unpaid was 5.6 million. Over the years, it's crept up, so at the end of the last financial year, it was 10.2 million. The cost of living crisis with rising food and energy prices is largely believed to be responsible for this. So it's less about people actually trying to avoid paying their council tax, but more people actually struggling to pay for it.
So what's the council going to do about it?
Well, the council does have a lot of schemes to help people who are struggling to pay their tax through reduction schemes, payment plans, but they also say they're robust in chasing down those who aren't paying and will pursue it until it's no longer financially viable. If we look over the time the £24 million has gone unpaid, the cumulative total of all of that was unpaid at the end of each financial year is actually nearer to £46 million. But over the years, it's been whittled down as £22 million has been clawed back through payment plans and even harsher measures such as repossessions. We've heard it before and we've discussed here many times about the difficult financial position for Medway Council. So making sure it's getting everything it absolutely can is obviously pretty important to try and stave off those problems.
So, Simon, what have you been working on?
Well, it emerged this week that the Immediate Justice Programme has lost its funding. This was a scheme that was announced in January by the Kent Police and Crime Commissioner, Matthew Scott, and this would be to tackle antisocial behaviour in a swift way. Offenders would be made to carry out community work, often within 48 hours of the offence being committed, and this was due to start in the autumn.
So why has the Home Office pulled the funding?
Well, Kent was earmarked around about £1 million of Home Office money to enhance the neighbourhood policing model, particularly focusing on those so-called hotspot crime areas, which we've dealt with before, and half of the money would be devoted to the Immediate Justice Programme. But late last month, the Home Office wrote to Mr Scott and all the other commissioners in the country saying it would not be sensible for Kent to carry on, so there'll only be 10 forces who will carry out the pilots, and Kent isn't going to be one of them.
What was the commissioner's response?
Well, he was disappointed, but he's actually vowed to try and press on with it, find the funding from somewhere else, work with local groups, etc., to do that, and so he can keep this immediate justice concept despite the financial setback. His exact words were, "This is not a time to be scaling back schemes that will reduce reoffending and prevent crime. I'm working with a number of groups of an immediate and justice reform programme so the perpetrators are held to account for their behaviour, and I'll launch my plans later this year." So, I mean, it's fair to say that the commissioner was very enthusiastic about the project, and when he announced it in January, she was very disappointed to find out that it was gone.
And what did the Home Office say officially about this?
The Home Office took their own line. They laid the blame at the previous government's door because the immediate justice pilot in places like Kent would take a lot longer than the 6 months that it was funded for. So perhaps the implication was that the scheme wasn't that well thought through. The statement from the Home Office said this would not have been an effective nationwide programme for tackling antisocial behaviour, nor offer value for taxpayer money, even more so in the light of the state of public finances which this government has inherited. But the, as I said, the Commissioner has promised to keep us posted on the progress of getting a similar scheme going in Kent this year. So we'll have to watch that space. So, Matt, what's caught your eye in the national scene?
Well, it seemed like the summer came to a shuddering halt in Westminster this week when the Prime Minister made a major speech in the garden of Downing Street, warning of trouble ahead for all of us, such as the perilous state of the public finances. He said there's some really hard decisions coming our way.
And what does he mean by that?
He was very much laying the groundwork for the October budget, where the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, is expected to hike taxes. We'll obviously find out which ones then. The government is keen to make clear they aim to protect working people. This is a term which could mean anything to anyone. I'm still not quite sure what it means.
OK. Well, Sir Keir said the situation Labour inherited was far worse than they imagined it would be, talking about this £22 billion black hole. And what did the Tories have to say about that then?
Well, we saw some response from the Tories along the lines of Labour's always intended to whack taxes up no matter what. But to be honest, it was all half-hearted stuff, bearing in mind that they're in a weird place, the Tory party at the moment. They're looking for a new leadership team, and Rishi Sunak is leader in name only at the moment, something you were speaking to our special guest about later.
Mm, I certainly will. So, right, what else has been happening?
So no sooner had Mr Starmer made his Downing Street garden speech and he was off to Berlin and Paris to meet with the German Chancellor and French President, his aim being to reset relations with our two most important European allies.
And why would this matter to someone who's in Kent?
Yeah, it's a good question. I suppose the answer is that after a dysfunctional decade in all our dealings with Europe, a reset is probably well overdue. But in terms of Kent, there's so many issues which need sorting out, from small boats to trade to the rules that people need to follow simply to pass through Dover. It's going to be really interesting to see what happens, but it's key stuff. And I would imagine Nigel Farage and co. will be keeping an eye on what Mr Starmer does.
Tunbridge MP Tom Tugendhat is one of six contenders for the leadership of the Conservative Party. Not an easy gig weeks after the pounding the party took at the general election. Tom, thank you so much for your time today. How are you?
Yeah, I'm on good form, thanks. I've just been getting around the country and meeting activists and meeting people. It's been good fun.
Good. Okay, listen, the first question, why go now? Your party's been reduced to 121 seats after securing a landslide in 2019. Surely we'd better to hang back a bit and see what the lie of the land might be.
Oh, we know that opposition matters and that leadership matters at every level. And I'm standing because I believe that our country needs leadership. And frankly, what we've seen out of Keir Starmer in recent days only proves it even more. The truth is that getting the right leadership in at every level in our country makes life better for the British people. And I'm standing to make sure that we actually get in the challenges and the scrutiny on this government so that we're ready for preparing the ground for a Conservative administration in 5 years' time.
Well, what do you think Keir Starmer's done wrong? Surely he's had quite a good record, especially when it comes to the riots, for example. I mean,
seriously, Simon? Seriously, he was late on calling Cobra. He was late in deploying the police. He was late in making sure that we arrested people. Frankly, he was the director of public prosecutions 13 years ago, when the riots happened in London. And he didn't seem to have remembered any of the lessons that he learnt then. And that's why the riots, even though they were smaller than they were 10 years ago, went on for longer. Now, I don't think that's a record of leadership. I really don't. And then what he's been announcing today, I mean, frankly, his claims on the economy are laughable. The economy in the UK is the fastest growing in the G7 and is in a significantly better position than it was in 2010. And his claims are completely absurd. But he's using it as an excuse to raise taxes, because his plan has always been to raise taxes. He just didn't have the courage to be honest with the British people about it.
You served as Security Minister with a seat in Cabinet under Prime Ministers Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak. So you were there on the inside. At what point do you think did it all go wrong?
Well, I think there's lots of different areas that went wrong. I mean, fundamentally, we failed to deliver on lowering migration and lowering taxes. But, you know, on many other areas, we delivered extremely effectively. Look at the stats on education in England, and I can certainly speak as a Kent MP here. The number of good and outstanding schools in our community has gone up over the last 14 years.
And that contrasts really remarkably with the drop in education standards in Labour-run Wales or SNP-run Scotland. What we've got to do now is make sure that those changes that mean that the top grades were going to free schools and to academy schools are maintained, because already Keir Starmer's now talking about not just taxing people who send their kids to private school, but effectively overloading the state system with those kids who won't be able to afford it anymore. Now, that's going to hurt all of us, going to hurt everybody, including those of us whose kids go to state schools.
But you put it down to migration and taxation, really, that's where the rot set in. You were never one of Boris Johnson's greatest fans. Did he do the damage before it got to Truss?
Well, look, we can look historically at all of this, if you like, but the real question is, how do we fix things in the future? And, you know, we've got to bring back integrity in politics, and we've got to bring back honesty in politics. And that's why I'm really quite worried about what Keir Starmer has already started doing. Just look at his appointments. If you give a few thousand pounds to the Labour Party, you can become a senior civil servant, apparently. In fact, they're already putting party political people onto the body that is supposed to hold party politics to account. You know, that not only have they taken Sue Gray from being supposedly independent to being absolutely key to their system as the chief of staff to the Prime Minister, but they would rather chief of staff to the Labour Party leader, first of all, and then later the Prime Minister. But they're now appointing Labour apparatchiks into the so-called institutional unit, vetting unit, that's supposed to hold ministers to account. I mean, they're just politicising the system. It's really, it's very worrying.
But there's always been accusations of cronyism in politics, no matter, you know, which government.
This is different. And let me tell you why it's different. Because there has been accusation of cronyism, and there has been accusation of putting mates into jobs, but this is literally the very, very first time when a political appointee has gone into the heart of the Cabinet Office, that bit of the Cabinet Office that is supposed to be so completely politically neutral, it's supposed to be judging whether or not ministers have behaved with integrity and according to the ministerial code. Now, if you're going to put your political friends into that bit, well, frankly, the rest of it doesn't matter. You might as well just bribe the judges while you're at it.
Kent has been a Conservative caddy for you know, many, many decades, and has now been reduced to six MPs. Was this as much to do with reform as the unpopularity of the government?
Well, let's be honest, the most people who didn't vote Conservative chose to do something else, chose in fact not to vote for another party, but chose to stay at home. And that's what we've seen, and that's extremely concerning. What we've got to do now is we've got to rebuild, and the way we've got to rebuild is by making sure we're delivering on a Conservative agenda. And that's why I'm standing very clearly to bring back Conservative values into our public life and make sure that what we're doing is standing up for the British people.
What do you think actually went wrong in Kent? I mean, the Conservative brand has always been very strong. What happened in Kent? What was the problem that you should lose such a lot of seats?
I mean, Kent is part of the United Kingdom, and we've seen the same effects across the whole of the United Kingdom. And so, you know, there's an awful lot of, I'm very proud of being in the sovereign and independent kingdom of Kent, but the reality is we are very fixed into the United Kingdom, and the issues that we've seen across England, Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland have played out in Kent as well. And of course, for us in particular, we are very much on the front line of the immigration challenge, and that's one of the reasons why we've had difficulties.
Why do you think the Conservatives managed to fail to stop the boat crossings? I know that the Labour Party's got this rule called smash the gangs, but, you know, successive governments in the last 30 years have put the best brains of Whitehall up against this and still failed to solve it.
That's not true. That's just not true. The reality is that the first really serious attempt to stop the small boat crossings was really begun only a few years ago, and that was with the deterrence scheme. Now, I'm not going to pretend for a second that any of us are particularly pleased about the Rwanda scheme. We're not, but we need a deterrence that makes sure that people aren't putting the lives of many others at risk by trying to smuggle them over the channel. Now, we need to be absolutely clear that a deterrent is incredibly important. And what Labour have just done is they've just dropped the deterrence. Okay, they've rebranded the small boats operational command that we've had in place for a number of years. The reason that that isn't enough on its own is because the channel is very narrow, and because you go straight from French waters to British waters without a single millimetre between them. And so what you need to do is you need to have a deterrent. And that's why the Rwanda scheme, or whatever it will now have to become in 5 years' time when we're looking to reset it, is so important. And we're not alone in saying that. The Danes do it, the Italians do it, the Spanish do it, many other countries do it. In fact, we are now going to be an outlier for a country that is not looking to do it. And I think that's extremely concerning, because effectively what Keir Starmer has done is he's changed the incentive structure, and he's made it clear that it is going to be profitable to smuggle people into the United Kingdom. And I think that's very worrying.
You were very well thought of in the security sector when you were serving as the minister, and you must have known what the security threats were within this particular problem about the small boats. I mean, did you get a valuable insight into why this has persisted?
Yes, and you know, an awful lot of this is to do with the drivers, and many of those drivers is to do with the economics of it. You know, it is a very profitable business, and that's why the deterrent is so important, because the reality is there's only so much you can do with the small boats operational command. Well, we know that, and that's why, despite having had it for, I think it's now 6 or 7 years, it's quite a long time that it's been going, we knew that we needed a deterrent as well. Now, sadly, all that Labour have done is they've rebranded the small boat operational command, and they've scrapped the deterrent.
If I was to stop someone in the street in your constituency, which is Tunbridge, and ask them to say something about Tom Tugendhat, what do you think they would say?
Well, you'll have to ask them, but I hope what they'd say is that I'm devoted to our community and I do my absolute best for it, because the reality is that our community in Tunbridge, all the way from Edenbridge all the way to Wateringbury and New Ash Green, is a fantastic part of Kent and an absolutely beautiful corner of our country. And it's absolutely wonderful to be able to represent it.
You're going to be up against Priti Patel, Robert Jenrick, Kerry Badenoch on the right, and sort of more centrist politicians like yourself, James Cleverly and Mel Stride. What makes you different from all the rest?
Well, first of all, I mean, this is a slightly odd election in the sense that we're all Conservatives, we're all standing on a Conservative ticket, and we're all friends. James has been a friend since we got elected. Kemi, when we had rooms next to each other, would come and sleep on my sofa when she was pregnant with her third child. And, you know, we're good mates. So this is a very different kind of an election. And so what this is really about, it's about leadership and it's about delivery, because we don't just need somebody who can reform the Conservative Party. And we don't just need somebody who can take the fight to Keir Starmer. We need somebody who is able to actually lead this country. We need somebody who is ready to, you know, in 4 years' time, to be the person we want to put forward as Prime Minister. And that's a really, really big job, and it's a very different job from the reorganisation or the management that we've seen before.
Should you become leader, how would you set about turning the Conservative Party's fortunes around?
Well, the first thing to do is to remember who you work for. Look, frankly, the Conservative Party is sometimes forgotten, that we are the servants of the country and the servants of our membership. Now, that's where we need to get the energy back, because, you know, too often our associations have felt like they are merely supporters and not the inspiration for party policy and for party ideas. And, you know, we've all seen, sadly, candidates foisted on associations at the last minute. We need to stop that. We need to make sure that the associations and the members are back in charge of the party. And that's exactly what I'll do.
Do you think the people might just think you're a bit too posh for modern politics?
Well, I hope that's something other people will have to decide, but I hope people will look at experience. You know, 13 years soldiering in Afghanistan. I don't think the Taliban thought that their bullets were selecting on the basis of that, and I don't think that, you know, the mines in the ground were deciding on the basis of where I was from. They were deciding on the basis of what I was standing for and who I was defending, and I was defending the British people and our interests, and that's what I always stand for, and that's what I'll always defend.
Obviously, people will put the fact that, you know, you're the son of a High Court judge, you were privately educated, you know, you went to Cambridge, you know, you were a lieutenant colonel in the army, you served as a military assistant to the chief of the defence staff. I mean, you have been a high flyer, but, you know, it's not exactly the CV of a docker, is it?
Well, it's my CV, and I'm always going to be honest with who I am. If you want me to pretend to be somebody else, I'm afraid you've got the wrong interview. I'm deeply proud of having served in the armed forces. I'm very, very proud of having been promoted on merit, as the armed forces does. And I'm very proud of the service that I was able to give the country in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, serving on military operations, I'm afraid, I know you're trying to make this a class-based argument, but I'm afraid bullets don't respect class, and nor do bombs, and nor does rank. Rank is about making sure that you're serving those you command and those you lead. And that's exactly what I did.
How do you sort of describe your personality?
I don't.
You don't? Why not?
I leave it for others.
You served as an army reserve, and as well, now you just described it in some detail, you know, what it was like to be a soldier in difficult, hostile environments. Do you think that experience shaped you in any way?
Oh, yeah, and of course it did. You know, serving the armed forces shapes all of us. And mostly it shapes us by teaching us about our country. I mean, you, Simon, you've worked in a studio for 20 years, being very isolated and working only with journalists. So you've had a very limited exposure to our country. Whereas as a soldier, you actually get to meet people from across the whole of the United Kingdom. You work with people who have been in care all their lives before they've joined the army. You work with people whose reading and writing wasn't great until they joined the army. You work with people who come from very, very different backgrounds. People who come from England, Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland. People who are sometimes very rich and sometimes very poor. So very different from working in your type of world where you live in this isolated bubble. You actually have to work across the whole of the United Kingdom.
Well, I would respond to that, Tom, actually, but I don't spend my life in the studio, actually. I've spent most of my career out on the road, but that's beside the point.
Tom Tugendhat, MP for Tonbridge and Tory Party leadership contender, thank you very much indeed for your time today. All the best.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
That was a fascinating listen there, you and Tom speaking, Simon. But what are the actual mechanics now of what happens with the leadership election?
Well, as I understand it, the current six candidates will be whittled down by the MPs to just two, and then that goes out to the wider membership of the Conservative Party. So if you're a member, you've got to vote, and then whoever that is will be the next leader. And effectively, the politics of that is that, according to some, if the MPs choose two candidates, one's likely to be on the right, one's likely to be a centrist. And as Craig McKinley said to us the other week, the former MP for Thanet, he said that the membership has a tendency to take the right winger.
Yeah, it does seem like that. After your chat with Tom there, what are your feelings? Do you think he's got the right stuff to be leader of the opposition?
Well, Tom Tugendhat is seen by many people as being the sensible choice. Because if the party lurches too far to the right and they choose someone like Priti Patel, they then go into conflict with Reform UK, and then they will also lose some of the soft Tories. So the smarter betting might be that they do choose someone in the centre like James Cleverly or Tom, who will be able to have a broader appeal. Because when you're in the centre ground just slightly right of centre as opposed to being sort of more right wing, you've an opportunity to harden up on certain policies, certain aspects, say immigration or prisons or whatever, and have that greater appeal to the larger number of members if you're picked. So that would be a better long-term strategy, but the short-term strategy seems to be, according to who you speak to, is that they'll probably choose a right-winger.
So I mentioned in my bit there about the Starmer speech in Downing Street this week, where it sounded like things can only get bitter. Rob, what did you make of it?
I thought it was... I suppose the interesting part of it is not so much the speech itself. I mean, obviously there are interesting elements to it, sort of. But I think the tone and the way people have reacted to it is really interesting. I think there are some people who are saying, basically, this is a bit depressing. You know, it's not quite the thing Keir Starmer was promising before the election change and that sort of thing. But other people are saying, well, he's not sort of buttering us up. He's not trying to make it sugarcoat it all. He's basically telling us the truth of the situation. I don't know whether it will really work. I mean, we're in this sort of inverted commas honeymoon period, though some people are now saying that's over. So it's kind of a question of, is he trying to basically make things seem a lot worse than they possibly are? And then when it gets better, it looks even better.
But he has made a point that he says that well, what's been heavily hinted at is there's going to be no income tax rises, no national insurance rises, and no rises in VAT. So therefore, he's going to clobber the better off. So he doesn't really have a go at the vast majority of working people, because most people in work, probably the most people who are likely to vote, if you've got a stakehold in the world. Whereas people who maybe he could pay a bit in capital gains tax will be some people they wouldn't necessarily ever get a vote for him anyway.
Yeah, so it's a fair point. I mean, the age-old argument to that is that if you go after wealth creators and job creators, they'll bugger off, they'll go somewhere else. I mean, I used to work with someone when I first started my career whose dad just went off to France because he didn't want to pay so much tax. I'm not saying that's right, but I'm saying that is a reality of what happens when you go after the rich.
I think what's really interesting is sort of the way a lot of these things are being sort of phrased and couched, and the perception that the public is going to have of these. I mean, from this speech, you would be forgiven for thinking this is basically austerity replayed all over again. But there are discussions, apparently, it was reported, I think, today, that Rachel Reeves is looking at capital gains tax and inheritance tax, which obviously are looking at those wealthier earners. I think similarly, a couple of weeks ago, when Rachel Reeves gave that statement to the House of Commons about the state of the Treasury, she had a very gloomy sort of outlook. But on the exact same day, she had given public sector workers this massive inflation-busting pay rise, which is a very sort of not something the Tories would have ever done. But that barely got a mention in her speech. So I think it's quite interesting that Labour are doing things that lots of people on the sort of Labour supporters would really enjoy and really support, but they're not really shouting from the rooftops about it. They're talking more about these sort of less enjoyable aspects of running the country and talking about how things are going to be really difficult when they are making key changes.
I'm a bit of a fan, as crazy as it may seem, for the tone of the speech and the overall message, because I think we're long overdue someone treating us as grown-ups and saying, look, we're in a really difficult position, we've got to go through some hard steps to get out of it, but we have a plan and we're going to do it. I think the Conservatives missed a massive trick with the pandemic and furlough. They borrowed billions and billions to keep the economy going. They should have come out straight afterwards and said, look, there's going to be a price to pay for this. Treat people as grown-ups, and more often than not, they behave like it.
Mm. There were a few commentators at the time saying that, you know, enjoy it while you can, because this is going to be one hell of a party, but there's going to be a big hangover at the end of it. And that's what's happened, really, is that the country was left broke, essentially, so just having had a war.
That's right. That's right. It's a major historical event that we lived through. And I don't know what you two think, but I find it a bit refreshing to have someone give us bad news.
Mm. I think a possibility might be that, obviously, we're at the beginning of this parliament, and so we might see sort of the hard truths, as you're saying, now, as far away from an election as possible. And then by the time we get to that election point, obviously Keir Starmer will hope that the economy's grown even more and that we're in a better position, and then he can say, well, you know, I was willing to tell you the truth of how bad it was back then, you know I'm not going to mess you around, I'm not going to lie to you, and then look how great things are now, and then maybe throw in a couple of, oh, it's only going to get even better in the future.
Yeah, potentially. I mean, events, dear boy, is what they always say, isn't it? You never know what's going to be around the corner. So, you know, 5 years' time, Starmer could be looking at another landslide or looking for a new job. Great interview with Tom today, Simon. Who we got next week? We've got a special edition, haven't we?
Yes, next week is Lord Michael Howard of Lym. He's going to be speaking to us at length next week about his life and times.
And it's a special episode, so you won't hear any of us. It'll just be you and his lordship.
Yeah, well, it's more of his lordship than me.
Yeah, thank God for that.
Yeah. Okay, folks, that's your lot for this week. Thanks to Rob and Matt and our special guest, Tom Tugendhat. Don't forget to keep an eye on Kent Online for the latest politics news from across the county. All the best.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show with Rob Bailey on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.